Today is Wednesday, April 2nd, 2003. Public hearing on House Bill 5030, Department of Human Services, Health Services. We're continuing our hearings on public health services and their detailed budget presentation. And we have with us this afternoon Barry Cass and Gail Shipley, who's here in a different capacity. Gail at one time was over on this side of the aisle as a legislator. Welcome, Gail. And we have Mr. Naughton. So I think that unless Mr. Burke has something that he would like to talk about,
Madam Chair,
we get into hearing from the agency.
Madam Chair, I have some handouts, and I'd like to describe them. The first thing I've got is a two-page prioritized list for the Office of Public Health Systems. I don't know if you're going to, Ms. Shibley is going to testify specifically on the list, but it is available, and I will hand that out to the committee. The next thing I have is a prioritized service list, the principles that the department considered in developing these prioritized lists. And I will hand that out with your permission. And finally, a letter and a report on related to a budget note that discussed the efficacy and the cost of moving the health division from Portland to Salem. So I will be happy to hand those things out.
And you also have in front of you the unequal treatment that was that Vicki Nakashima mentioned yesterday that she would provide for you today. So you have that also at your stations.
That's all from me for now.
Thank you.
Madam Chair.
Oh, and I forgot to mention Rosie. Just so everybody knows, Rosie and Little Rosie are with us today and encourages, on the one hand, the use of acronyms so that she may be fed. And in feeding Rosie, those contributions at the end of session will go to the Oregon Food Bank. On the other hand, sometimes when you have to feed or you have to contribute, sometimes it's a deterrent to the use of acronyms. So it just depends upon how you look at it. And if there's anyone in the audience who has a cell phone, I would appreciate it if you turn it off so that it does not disrupt the proceedings. So we've completed our housekeeping items, and Barry, you're on.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm Barry Cass, Assistant Director of the Department of Human Services for Health Services. We have been discussing public health since Monday afternoon, and regulation is one of the important components of a comprehensive public health program. I think you'll recall that Grant Higginson, in his presentation about the role of the state public health officer, talked a little bit about approving certain plans for health facilities and other programs where there's a regulatory aspect. And Mike Skeels mentioned yesterday about the licensing of certain health laboratories. But today, Gail Shibley joins us to talk about really where most of the regulation is in health services. It relates to water, radiation, emergency medical services, health facilities, and probably the foundation of a good environmental health program, food protection, and the licensing and regulation of food services, which you, Madam Chair, are quite familiar with. It's an issue that we've been discussing for a number of years. So with that, I'm going to ask Gail to walk you through this part of the program. We do have in public health services 41 different services that are prioritized, and I assume we'll return to that list at some point when we start looking at what the dimensions of the program are and how we want to make decisions about that. So I'm pleased that Gail has joined the staff since I guess early February. We're really delighted to have her in a key management role in public health.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Gail Rosie the Hammer Shibley. I appreciate you feeding me but I will try to stay on a fairly strict diet. As I am the administrator for the Office of Public Health Systems, and I have been on the job for about 40 days and 40 nights, flooded with a variety of rather urgent environmental public health issues of one stripe or another. As Barry laid out very eloquently at the beginning of his presentation a week ago or so, in terms of the assessment, policy, and assurance end, I truly am the assurance piece of that spectrum. And rather than read through each of the pages of the of section 457 through 481, what I'd like to do is relatively following that same order, I would rather just call out a couple specific pieces to bring to your specific attention. Clearly happy to provide additional information or answer questions or at least attempt to and make sure that you have the information you need. We are generally responsible for both environmental public health hazards as well as assuring access to quality health care, specifically through the trauma center and then, the system of trauma services in the state, as well as hospitals and other non-nursing home health facilities. And we do that in five different sections within my area. Barry mentioned that I do have 41 of 97 programs. It's roughly somewhere just north of $21 million, of which about $3.3 million is general fund. So it's a relatively small slice, and I'd be happy to highlight those for you as we go along. Clearly, as with everything in public health, as I'm learning in my vast tenure here to date, we do not do our work, and we could not do our work alone. The partnerships are absolutely key, whether that's in the local county public health services, advisory committees, other governments, industry, licensees, and so on. They are absolutely key to making sure that we can do our job. Within the healthcare licensure and certification, I thought I would be so helpful in pulling out the numbers as identified in your list of 97, not knowing that LFO was going to provide you a list of our 41. So if you would like to note on the list of 97, those under healthcare licensure and certification are, there are eight programs, and they are number 35, 49, 50, 51, 66, 68, 72, and 75.
Well, Madam Chair.
Representative West.
Perfect. Could you repeat those numbers again?
Madam Chair, Representative West, I'd be happy to. Yes, 35, 49.
Hold on. Okay, 35, 49,
50, 51,
66, 68,
72, and 75.
Thank you.
And we assure quality health care by regulation of acute care facilities as well as community-based facilities and some caregivers, including portable x-ray suppliers, hemodialysis technicians, and others. No general funds are received in this section. Mostly they are federal pass-throughs through the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services, the Center for Medicare and Medicaid Services, I believe it's called, headquartered in Baltimore, as well as some licensure fees.
Since they changed your name.
Pardon me?
Never mind, go ahead. But you owe Rosie.
I'm sorry?
You owe Rosie.
It's okay.
Oh, I'm sorry. Yes, I'm just reading the name tag there. It says LFO staff.
I'm going to take care of this for you just once.
Thank you, boss. Under our environmental services and consultation, those the programs contained or overseen by that section are 15 of our 41 or 15 of the 97. So if you are ready, I will give you that list of numbers as well. I apologize that there are so many of them, and yet that's the way it goes. They start at number 34. Then 43, 52, 54, I feel like I work at a bingo parlor, yeah. 65, 76, 80, 81, 85, 86, 87, 91, 94, 96, and 97. And this very diverse section is responsible for really one of the leading roles of the state in ensuring public safety from environmental hazards, including, as Barry mentioned, a very strong food service program. Madam Chair, I do, that is one of the pieces that I want to bring to your committee's attention. With tremendous assistance through the Conference of Local Health Officials and the individual county public health administrators, as well as through the Oregon Restaurant Association and others who are focused on and concerned about ensuring food safety for the dining public. We began several months ago, before my tenure, to look at what would it take to restructure in statute as well as in operations to ensure that the system is fair, consistent, reliable, and what are the appropriate roles for the different entities. And I believe that we are making very, very solid, significant progress to coming to consensus and very significantly and beneficially, I think, for all parties, amending House Bill 3156 introduced by Representative Cruz to reflect a food protection program that is part of an integrated public health system delivered locally with strong state oversight. And modeled after the 1999 Food and Drug Administration food code that we adopted as a state in January of 2002, really focusing on risk, basing everything on science, and driving decisions on data. And delivering that service, it's a state service delivered through intergovernmental agreement with the local public health authorities. Linda Fleming, who I believe was before your committee earlier, has played a very key role in leadership, and we could not do it without her, as well as I said, other entities involved in this.
Yeah, that suggests if you're looking at the inspection side based on science that... are you also planning, as a part of that, to train particularly the field staff?
Madam Chair, you're referring to the field staff, the inspectors. Mm-hmm. Is that correct? Madam Chair, I appreciate the question. Absolutely, and ensuring that not only do they know and understand what's required, but that they can explain it, communicate it, in a way that is both understandable, relevant, and consistent to the folks that they deal with around the state as well.
So am I to assume that the some of the categories that are currently under inspection will be probably changed if you're going to do it based on science?
Madam Chair, I couldn't give you the specifics that are contained in the federal code that we adopted as a state, but clearly we will be using that framework to drive the specific issues and items that we will be inspecting for, so that everybody, to put it another way, everybody is reading off the same page of the hymnal.
Yeah, I think that's where I was going, because what's occurring currently, everybody doesn't read off the same page in the same hymnal. And it's the inconsistency issue that is bothersome for the industry, where you may have an inspector in one county who doesn't really clearly go by what is scientific, and so they will have a different kind of write-up, where someone someplace else has something different, and the objective is to try to be consistent across the state so that we do have uniformity. So.
Yeah, Madam Chair, I appreciate that. The days of delegation, and that word may mean something to you as a restaurateur, are over. No longer will counties be delegated this responsibility. This will be seen as a state responsibility delivered locally, as part of an integrated system, and that delivery will be by annual intergovernmental agreement, reviewed in terms of scope of work, responsibilities, deliverables, etc. So we're very pleased about that direction, and very optimistic that we can change the system for the better in the ways that you described.
Are you collaborating any, and I know it's a separate issue, but it's one that we talk about in the industry, and that's with the Department of Ag. For some members, the state has responsibility for the inspection of restaurants and those entities, but you receive, you also have now restaurant activities inside of your supermarkets and other places, which is not inspected by the health agency, but is in fact inspected by the Department of Ag, which they undergo a different kind of inspection than what we undergo in the restaurant industry. So are you working with them as well, Gail?
Madam Chair, yes, very much so. At the same time, we, as you point out, it clearly is a different delivery system. The local county public health officials not only inspect restaurants, they also inspect schools, daycare centers, and other kinds of more public dining establishments. And we are trying to get everybody moving in the same direction. The counties point out to me that therefore they not only deal with us meaning the Department of Human Services, but they also deal with the State Department of Education. They also deal with other entities of the state in order to take care of the responsibility of one slice or another. So we all need to be working together.
Madam Chair, just one comment, not to distract Gail, but the agreement that we have reached with the counties and the Restaurant Association reflects both the need for a more consistent and accountable system, and also the progress that's been made over the past several years in bringing a more science-based approach to this. One of the differences with the Department of Agriculture is those are Department of Agriculture employees who are doing those inspections, and we don't anticipate a fundamental change in the structure of the food service program. What I think the industry is interested in is having a state agency which holds the local inspectors accountable for the same set of rules and imposes on the system a more or less consistent fee structure, which has been a problem for the industry as well. Anyway, I must tell you, I'm very, very impressed both with Gail's and Dr. Higginson's work to bring this together, and I'm also want to thank the counties for having stepped up to the plate on this, to use a sports metaphor. And
Representative Westland.
Taking that.
Thank you, and thank you, Gail, for this, I mean, very welcome report. My question, both either to you or Barry, is can you define fairly consistent fee structure? What does that mean?
Yeah. Madam Chair, Representative Westland, very, very important, very good question. What the agreement that we've reached specifies that the state, meaning our department, will set a marker in terms of the fees. The fees are currently in statute, and so clearly, anytime we want to raise our state fees for those counties, and there are 10 of them that don't have the infrastructure necessary to deliver this locally. So we, as a state, do provide that, and those fees are set in statute. Right now, the agreement that we've reached says that this fee marker, if a county using a cost-based formula feels that it needs to deviate from that marker, then they will identify those costs that require additional fees additions to those markers. For example, Multnomah County, I know, has the need to ensure to communicate with their licensees in something like a dozen different languages. Well, I could imagine that other counties in the state, that's not an issue. Or if it is, it's maybe, two or maybe three, but not 12. clearly, that increases, costs and requires some adjustment. Any county that deviates more than 20% above or 20% below that statewide marker will automatically trigger a fiscal audit by the state analysis so that the county then must verify what are those costs that are driving your ultimate fee schedule and then put it on us to ensure that those are in fact accurate, in line, appropriate. And if we find that is not the case, we have the authority, again under the agreement that we've reached so far, to immediately pull those back.
Thank you.
Okay. By the way, Madam Chair, we do not expect a general fund fiscal impact from this agreement. Everything in this in food service is driven by fees.
Yeah. Yes. Are you expecting any fee increases?
This biennium, Madam Chair, no. We are not planning on it. That's correct. Our drinking water program.
Senator Glenn.
Thank you very much. Before we go to the drinking water program, and good afternoon.
Good afternoon to you, Madam Chair, Senator Gordley.
I do have a couple of questions that can be answered, perhaps in information that could be provided in written form later. One, as you'll recall, in the Portland area, we had some problems with a few schools that had toxic hazards, mold. There was a concern about radon. And I know that there was some testing that took place around these schools in the Portland area. But I'm wondering, has there been a statewide survey of schools to look at other risks that might be, that we may need to be aware of and that need to be addressed? That's one question. And then I'm also concerned about the program that we've had underway that outreaches and provides testing for children who are at risk of blood lead poisoning. And I'm wondering where we are with that program and how much of the risk has been diminished as a result of the program of outreach and testing that has already taken place.
Madam Chair, Senator Gordley, I have to parenthetically say it brings me no end of pleasure to use that term. So I appreciate the opportunity to do that today. In terms of your second question, I will have to get back to you in written form in terms of specifics of the blood lead poisoning. I could tell you at a very high level kind of that we are continuing with that. But any specifics, I will have to get back to you on that. In terms of the statewide survey of risk, what you touched on is absolutely key. And actually, I wanted to bring to the committee's attention when I got to the drinking water and then also to the radiation protection section, a couple pieces of that. Part of it is just a function of program. A piece of it, for example, the drinking water program, had to do with lead in the water. And in fact, there was Portland Public Schools did some sort of assessment. I couldn't speak for them clearly, and this was a couple years ago. So I'm going at secondhand information here, and there was lead found. We worked with them to help them track down the source of that, and Corvallis School District. I'm probably not getting the exact name of the school district correctly, but
that's right.
They also did the testing and found the lead. This was suggested by the Environmental Protection Agency at the federal level. And we passed that through, encouraged the school districts in the state. Of course, there are 398 of them. We only know of the two that actually did it because we have no follow-up or direct connection to the school districts. They then came to us and said, we want to do this, and here's what we found, et cetera. So that's in terms of lead in the water. Sometimes it's a very simple fix. Mostly it only has to do with changing the plumbing. And it could be everything from a little bubbler in the drinking fountain to piping, et cetera. But we can help track down exactly where that lead is coming from. But they need to be doing that. We're not going to go into all the school districts around the state. Did you ask?
Yeah, I do actually. But why don't you finish your thoughts and then I'll
just and also in terms of indoor radon, I'll have something. In fact, I'll just bring it out right now. Again, through the Environmental Protection Agency and our Radiation Protection Section, we have a Consumer's Guide to Radon Regulation. Radon is an issue around the state, not only in schools, but depending on goes back to the Missouri flood about 12,000 years ago or so. But suffice it to say that there is radon around Oregon in various places, and you can literally get a radon detection kit, which again school districts, consumers, homeowners, etc. can get, and we encourage them to do that. All of that's on our website, and so that's a piece of it as well.
Madam Chair, Senator Gordley, just one comment, which is nothing inconsistent with what Gail has said. We are responsible for the water, regulating water systems. We do not have responsibility from the connection forward, and the schools do in that case. Our role was consultative to help schools solve that problem. But although lead is a concern in drinking water, the primary source of poisoning from lead is in paint. Our resources for this program come from the Environmental Protection Agency, and the investment in abatement of sources of lead in paint is very, very limited. At the same time, the EPA is putting pressure on the state to achieve the EPA standards for lead in drinking water, which is not the source where most people acquire lead poisoning, certainly not in this state. And so we have a problem with lead that we need to deal with, and a very, very constrained resource to do that at the federal level and certainly at the state level as well. And we do have a surveillance program for lead that includes Melcone shot, because the Environmental and Occupational Epidemiology Section, Michael Heumann's office, has a lead surveillance component. But what we do in public health systems is the regulatory part of that, and it's a part of our Environmental Services and Consultation Program. It's limited because the resources we have to work with communities in abating lead paint are extremely limited. And it's just, I think it's important because this story about the schools took a lot of attention of the press, but Lead poisoning is really a problem that's associated with old housing, old structures, and many times poor people live in those structures. And it becomes, as we pointed out, as a part of the Racial and Ethnic Health Task Force report, that's a major problem for people of color. So I just want to be clear that what we can and also what we can't do because of the resources we have.
I appreciate that. If I may follow up, Madam Chair, is there an existing report that captures where the lead-based paint issue is the greatest problem, where in the state, and is there also information already documented that would describe what more we should be doing around eliminating this hazard, and with a budget attached?
Madam Chair, Senator Gordley, I don't believe so, but I don't know. Dr. Michael Holcomb is our lead toxicologist within the Environmental Services and Consultation section, so I will tap into his considerable knowledge. In terms of dollars for our toxicology unit, they are general fund dollars. The requests for assistance and information at this point far outstrip our resources. I mentioned at the beginning of my presentation, Madam Chair, that I wanted to call your attention to a couple pieces. And what I failed to mention was that I also wanted to add a footnote in terms of emerging issues. And this is, Madam Chair, Senator Gordley, likely the lead on my footnote. I would put this under the category of emerging issues. And for example, the broad and very diverse category of environmental health is incredibly has grown significantly over the past several years as science has advanced, as our awareness has grown. Increasing concerns have generated just a ballooning of requests for information, attempts to resolve one piece or another. Indoor mold is just one example. Right now, we receive more than 1,000 calls a year regarding indoor mold, mold-related concerns. We have $0, zero people ascribed to focus on that. Now, and then in this legislative session, there are a number of bills, and you may know of, you may be a part of some of them, trying to grapple with this, you know, emerging area of environmental health concern. We are continuing to scramble and shift and reshift to focus on, again, based on science, based on understanding, based on awareness with our toxicologists and others, what we most need to be dealing with. But I will find out about the whether or not there's a specific report.
We'll bring it back.
Yes.
Thank you very much, Madam Chair.
Gail, just drop down to the next category.
Great.
And that is?
The drinking water?
I want to go to the drug labs.
I'm sorry. Okay, the drug labs. Actually, that's another very important, for instance, under emerging issues. When the legislature passed, when we first started this program in 1990, there were about 20 labs. And we set fees and so on based on, you know, the understanding at the time. The number of labs and therefore the number of the amount of work that we have to do has just ballooned since that time. In fact, I think the highest number that I saw was in 2001. There were 327 drug labs that we ensured were made fit again for human habitation. Now some of those are that we're aware of, frankly, haven't been cleaned up. They're out somewhere on somebody's piece of property out in a very rural area. Maybe it's a burned down mobile home or something that, you know, that just somebody's just left it. But if a particular structure is going to be fit for human habitation, then then that needs to be cleaned up. We then ensure that qualified folks do that abatement. We inspect it and then literally sign a certificate of fitness.
Is there a cost to the owner?
Yes, that's Madam Chair. That's precisely how it is. It is a license, or excuse me, not a license fee, but it is a fee that the property owner must pay.
And so your latest data is for 2001, correct? Is that the latest?
That is the latest, Madam Chair, that I have. I'm told by staff that we are on course for more than 200 labs this year.
Could you provide us, and you don't have to do it now, but go back and tell us, describe the chemicals or what's in those clandestines, whether it's methamphetamine, which I suspect that it probably is, to give us a percentage of what the contaminants and what you're having to clean up.
Madam Chair, I'd be happy to do that. I did ask that very question just a day or two ago and was told that they are basically 100% methamphetamine labs.
And I did get a tape that I will share with this with the committee on a drug house and a meth house. I think there were several that the Salem Police Department has put together. So, Mr. Britton, at some time we would like to have you set up. It's only, I think, about 7 to 12 minutes, but I think it's worthy of this panel looking at what's involved when you're talking about a house that has been for their manufacturing drugs.
Madam Chair, in terms of the drinking water program, I mostly want to call attention to one specific issue, and I'll reference it again in just another minute when I get to the budget notes, the enhancement packages. But the state of Oregon has primary responsibility for ensuring compliance with the federal Safe Drinking Water Act. And therefore, a big chunk, frankly, of our general fund dollars, actually it's about $1.2 million, is general fund, and you will see that under, and I think that's number 15 priority on the list of 97. There are two programs in drinking water. One is number 15, and I want to say maybe
47.
Okay.
Operator certification.
There we go. Yeah. Although that needs to be completed. Somehow it got truncated, and that also includes assistance to local communities as well. It's not only to certify operators, but this primacy, as it's called, that ensures that Oregonians are responsible for Oregon's safe drinking water, is absolutely dependent on making sure that we have the state match dollars to get that federal Environmental Protection Agency dollars, and that our program is no less stringent. Barry, I know, mentioned the other day that there was an audit by the Secretary of State's office on drinking water, and we have taken very, very seriously both the findings and, most importantly, we believe, the recommendations of the auditors in terms of how to ensure that we do the very best job possible. This was given or came out in January 2001, and there are a list of things. I'd be happy to go through any specifics of them with you in terms of the status of the actions we've taken. I'm already bumping up against my time.
The committee was given a summary of that.
Okay. In terms of the actions we've taken to date, Madam Chair? Or?
No, just the audit.
Okay. All right. But this was truly a wake-up call, not only for us, but we believe also for the local water suppliers. Very, very important problem or important issue. And as I mentioned earlier, as the science is continuing to advance, the standards are continuing to increase from the federal government, and we need to ensure that Oregonians have safe drinking water no matter where they are.
Is there a document to say how we compare with other states?
Madam Chair, are you speaking about in terms of conformity with the federal government?
I actually Madam Chair, I can answer. We do have a report which compares Oregon with neighboring states in the Northwest, and I'll have a copy of that for you.
Are we better or in the middle, or where are we?
Madam Chair, relatively less expensive. I can't evaluate the quality of those services from the report I have. That was not the intent.
I always thought Bull Run was the best. At least when I grew up in Portland, that's what my dad used to say.
Mm-hmm. And Madam Chair, we really have very good drinking water in the state of Oregon. That's the good news. The concern that we all ought to have is that clearly a variety of things, a very wide variety of things, can in fact impact directly and indirectly on the quality of our drinking water. So whether it's forest practices or whether it's pesticide runoff or whatever it might be, that those things are all related, and it's very clearly a top priority for us.
Whether it's our treatment centers.
Madam Chair, you're absolutely right. Emergency medical services and trauma systems. There are 7 programs contained therein, and again, I'd be happy to give you those numbers, those program numbers, if you'd like. In terms of the list of 97, they are number 23, 24, 25, 33, 46, 48, and 64. Madam Chair, I know that there has been an earlier discussion about calling specific attention to services for children. Clearly, whether it's safe drinking water or lead-based paint or a whole variety of other things, that's part and parcel of what we do, and it's very core to our mission. I do want to call attention to number 64 that I just noted, which is emergency medical services for children. And lest anyone think incorrectly that we've rated that either the lowest within this particular section or that we don't seem to care too much about emergency medical services for children, I simply want to make an important notation here that, frankly, without the trauma services that I think are number 23, as well as ambulance licensing and the other pieces of this, of the trauma system, we literally would not have the infrastructure to provide the consultation to pediatric units in hospitals and trauma centers that are part of this number 64 program for children without these other pieces. I hope that that's clear. Perhaps Dr. Representative Bates can tell me if I'm incorrect in that. But literally, we need those other pieces in place in order to ensure that children have the kind of services that they need under a trauma system.
Madam Chair.
Representative Bates.
It's an area of special concern for me, not only children, but the trauma system itself. EMS children obviously need transportation taken care of too. This helps cover that. We've had deaths in the state because we couldn't properly transport in a timely way children into Emanuel or OHSU, and we're aware of that and are working on it. I wonder if you could tell the committee just real quickly the concern, and I assume it's the same concern I have, that your job here is really oversight of the trauma system, but our trauma system the last 4 or 5 years or a little longer has been going backwards, and our level twos and threes and fours are going to twos and threes to fours and fours out of the system, and the risk that presents to Oregonians is real, that we'll have people dying in this state, because even though we have a system in place, there's no actually any base to that system other than a declining numbers of hospitals are taking part in it, who are doing less and less at each center because of cost factors. There's legislation to address that, but I'd like to hear your position on that real quickly.
Madam Chair, Representative Bates, thank you very much, and I also want to thank you for your leadership in ensuring that the state of Oregon does have a solid or could have a solid statewide system of trauma services. Absolutely critical. The first bill that I testified on, I think I was in office or in office. I was in this job all of maybe 5 or 7 days, and I testified on a bill that had very significant impacts to our trauma system, the so-called golden hour. From the time that a trauma does occur, the clock is ticking, and the sooner that individual can get the appropriate trauma services, the exponentially higher the odds of recovery are. And consequently, by the time you actually get an ambulance to whatever that site is, get them to the nearest medical center, there's some sort of triage that takes place there. They determine that, gosh, we don't have the appropriate staff. It's beyond our ken. We need to somehow get them to the next level up, or even perhaps 2 levels up, and then actually getting them there with the 4 helicopters and the fixed-wing aircraft, if necessary, depending on the remote areas of the state where these traumas can and do occur, that precious, irrecoverable time is lost. And so without a very solid, reliable, statewide system of trauma services in this state, we are literally playing with people's lives.
Madam Chair, Representative Bates, I would only add to that candidly, this is a financial problem. We finance actual services through the medical care system, and to the extent that system is in crisis, there is a crisis in providing trauma services. It takes, and I've read every trauma certification report for the past 18 months because we, as you pointed out, there has been change and stress in that system. And it takes enormous leadership in the clinical community and in the hospital community to bring together a structured program at the local level. But the question for the future is, are the resources there and are they targeted? And I think that's a question that we're going to have to struggle with as we observe the changes. Our role is not to fund trauma care in this branch. It's to work with the State Trauma Advisory Board to maintain a registry, to do the certification, and to provide you with data about which direction we're moving. And frankly, it has become more troubling. And I think it's largely an issue of healthcare financing that needs to be examined. I hope I haven't gone too far, because I think your expertise
Thank you, Madam Chair. I know I think this committee's time up for this, but this is a major problem in Oregon. It's getting worse. We do have a bill to address that through 911 fees, and we're going to try and move that. But I just wanted to make a point that your job is oversight, make sure the systems are certified and functioning. The other half is that there's a system there. And you guys are kind of the glue that holds it together, and then the real work occurs in the hospitals, and we're losing that. Yes, thank you.
Thank you,
Madam Chair.
Thank you. Please continue.
Thank you. Radiation Protection Services consists of 8 programs, and those numbers, and this is the last time I'll read out a string of numbers. I appreciate your indulgence. They are programs number 39, 44, 53, 62, 63, 67, 92, and 95. And I already mentioned the indoor radon program. There are, of course, the radiological emergency response, licensing radioactive materials, as well as ensuring that that patients, frankly, whether those patients are in a doctor's office, hospital, dentist's office, or even a veterinary clinic, that those machines are safe and reliable, and that the operators neither the operators nor the patients are exposed to excessive amounts of radiation. as well as the Mammography Quality Standards Act, the Food and Drug Administration has provided us a 5-year contract to, and we went through very specific testing of mammography machines to ensure that we had both the hardware as well as the knowledge to monitor these machines. We are in the second year of that 5-year contract with the federal government for that. Just a footnote regarding indoor radon, and I won't belabor it at this point, but at this point it is an inquiry and or complaint-driven system. We simply don't have the resources to, in a proactive way, go after what is a fairly broad dispersion of radar concerns around the state. There are these again are primarily licensee and registrant fee-driven programs, zero general fund dollars in those radiation protection services. I want to call your attention to the enhancement packages that are listed on page 4-79. And tell you that specifically on package 166, that's a public health fee-based programs, there are actually a couple different segments to that, and I don't know that you received a corrected page or not. The one that's in my book, they did. Okay, good. So I think it should call attention to the fact that we are not pursuing this policy option package as it relates to food service licensing, inspection, public pool and spa, as well as plan reviews. What we are continuing to move forward on is relating to ensuring that Oregon continues to be in charge of our drinking water program, not the EPA. Chair Winters, I believe you received, as well as I believe Representative Jensen, chair of the House Water Committee, received a letter from the Environmental Protection Agency, Region 12 up in Seattle, stating some real concerns of a resource basis that the state of Oregon has what it takes to really make sure that our program is running on full steam ahead. And we have run into some significant concerns by water users, water suppliers, special districts, League of Oregon Cities, and others about our proposal, House Bill 2255, to include a direct fee on direct connections that would work out to approximately 60 cents a year, $1.20 a biennium, to ensure this primacy. What we have agreed to at this point with them is to work very diligently and focusedly, if that's an adjective, during the interim to determine, okay, if you don't like a direct connection fee, we all can agree that we don't want the federal government in charge of our drinking water, so what do we have to do? Where is the money going to come from to make sure we have the kind of program and system in place to keep control of it ourselves? So we are pursuing that, but it's not the bill as written. We will be coming forward with some amendments for that bill. In terms of...
Didn't we have this under discussion last session? This particular issue on the connection and some of the oversight that was coming from the federal agency.
Madam Chair, I don't know. I will check on that for you. I personally was not here, but...
Madam Chair, there was a discussion about connection fees, and the audit was published in January, but neither Gail nor I were in the roles we're in now, so we'll have to do some research to answer your question.
My little memory bank said it was some discussion.
And in terms of the in-home care licensure and inspection program, there's a note here on package 165, and that's as it relates to a bill last session or session before, Senate Bill 333. We are in the process right now with my 40 days and 40 nights tenure of reviewing not only the fees in this part of my office, but frankly throughout the office, and we'll provide that information to you.
Actually, Madam Chair, just for clarification, this is the budget side of the 333 requirement, since these fees are set by rule rather than statute.
Mr. Britt?
Just to clarify on that, Barry and George, and Gail, is there a do you have a bill that's going to tie to that? Because this typically a Senate Bill 333 bill comes with would come with this budget, and I and something that this committee needs to deal with.
Madam Chair, let me check on exactly how that's flowing through. I believe there was a department-wide bill that had all of the Senate Bill 333 related to administrative fees in one bill.
In one bill.
But let me check into that.
Okay.
So, in closing, Madam Chair, I just want to again bring attention from a footnote standpoint that clearly we are trying to manage with existing resources and the fees, the small amount of general fund that we do have, these emerging issues and respond to the legislature, to citizens, to others, whether it has to do with mold, mercury, bioaccumulation of toxins, drinking water safety, the drug labs, indoor radon, ultrasound, laser, microwave, magnetic resonance imaging, and so on. And I just want to make sure that as policymakers you are aware that that these issues are continuing to grow. We may not be dealing with them this session, but as we continue to look forward and plan for Oregon's future, they need to be in our consciousness. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you. Is there any questions?
Madam Chair,
Senator Gordon.
Did we address the budget notes about the drinking water enforcement?
Yeah, that's where I was going to.
The budget notes are pretty...
1881.
479,
4-79. 480. 480, 481.
Madam Chair, Senator Gordley, I did...
You did mention it.
In terms of both the... both in terms of House Bill 2255 and then also referencing the Secretary of State's audit. Again, I'd be happy to provide you specific information, relating to the status of each of these recommendations. Suffice it to say that that we have made considerable progress, if not completely done, all of the recommendations that were outlined to the department, recommendations to the department, whether it's database, increased inspection intervals, and others.
Thank you, Madam Chair. That's what I needed to hear on record. Thank you. Thank you.
Any further questions? Representative Bates.
Just a couple real quickly. The funding for emergency medical services for children is the same that we talked about over here on the other page, I believe, just to make sure that's clear.
Madam Chair, Representative Bates, that's correct.
It's been unfunded now, but we're going to try to refund that. I was wondering about the 0507 licensing and registration fee increases. Was this to help you with the water situation or looking at some the need to raise licensing substantially in the next biennium? And I guess my question would be, if you're forecasting that, would it be better to raise it a smaller amount now and a smaller amount then? And what are we looking at here, these kind of fee increases?
Madam Chair, Representative Bates, since the discussions in the department about this are far older than 40 days and 40 nights, I think it might be easier for me to answer, and that is that in examining the fee issues for the coming biennium, we discovered that we had sufficient resources to carry us through in healthcare licensing and certification. But we wanted the committee to be aware that we anticipate that by the next biennium, there will need to be fee increases in that area. We appreciate that the state's goal is to hold fee adjustments to the minimum necessary to get the job done. And since we don't need those revenues in the coming biennium, but anticipate that we will, we wanted to send you a message to anticipate that. Beyond that, I don't know what else to say. I can certainly provide more information for the committee.
He's saying he's been given a hold-the-line instruction.
I guess, Madam Chair. It just seems strange to me that you've got enough for this biennium, and the next biennium you got to jump at 35 to 40%. It just seems like a strange figure. And maybe you can give us more information.
I will.
Senator Morris.
Madam Chair, thank you. What is the budget, governor's budget, for your department?
Madam Chair, Senator Morris, the governor's balanced budget total fund for my office, is that what you're asking?
Yes.
Okay. I have that number, and maybe Mr. Naughton can correct me if I'm wrong, as 21,187,954.
That's on
you. A question for LFO. On the LFO presentation under the public health systems, it shows a budget of
1,532,000. Senator Morris, I'm going to let... Mr. Britton, explain the whole budget, because I think he and I talked earlier about the disparities that are existing in the budget, and this may be an opportune time, John,
sure,
to make those explanations.
Madam Chair and Senator Morris, the answer to your first question on the $21 million is that most of the $21 million is in program support and central admin. So what is it 1 million? I didn't hear what.
No.
In the LFO presentation, there's like $1 million. Those represent the special payments only that are made. The rest of this budget, the rest of the 21 million, is in program support and central administration.
That would be part of that 314 million.
Correct. That's right. That's right.
Thank you.
And I might add that that is true for all of the public health programs that we've heard about, that when you look at those four offices, those numbers are much lower than the total public health budget because they do not include staffing, and that staffing is in the program support and central admin section.
Go ahead and make your other comments.
Okay. A couple other things, assuming we're done with this particular program area. Okay. Yesterday, the question was asked by the committee with respect to the Office of Family Health. There was $1 million of general fund office priority number one, Babies First Local Services. And I believe the question was, why is there no federal match? And the answer to that is that this general fund is paid to counties. They, in turn, may add some of their own money, and that is sent back to the Office of Medical Assistance Programs. They match it with Medicaid and return all of the money to the counties. Counties do not contract directly with the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services. They have to go through the designated state unit, which in this case is the Department of Human Services.
I still would like to have from the agency what those dollar figures are that we're sending out, how much is being matched, and how much are we capturing.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. That's for. I think Lynn is, or whomever is the staff person responsible for getting those figures.
The other comment I wanted to make is that I was able to meet with the department budget staff this morning, and the issue, Senator Morris, that you raised the other day about the numbers and the variation when you look at those numbers, particularly with respect to mental health and addiction services, and also in the LFO write-up, the program support and central admin. The department wants to respond to your questions on that, and I think they're able to and would like to meet with you and anybody else that is interested to reconcile those numbers. But they are able to explain them and want to do so, sir.
Thank you. Is that appropriate for a work session, Madam Chair?
When we get into work session, I think then we will be able to talk about the numbers, because I would not want for one member to have information and not all the members to have mm-hmm. the information. I think mm-hmm. that all the members need to know, why and what and how you reach and what the assumptions are. So I think that all need to
absolutely. Mm-hmm. But the department wants to respond to your questions along those lines.
Thank you.
Okay. Thank you.
Madam Chair, just a couple of remarks before we move on, if I may.
Certainly.
One is, lest there be any misunderstanding about fee issues. Actually, there's no direction from outside the department or from outside of my office about that. If any of the administrative offices have fees that are appropriate to their area, and they bring forward a budget issue about increasing those fees, we need to be convinced that that's necessary. And when there are carryover revenues from fee resources, we don't need to do that. However, I think in response to Representative Bates' question, the responsibilities of our licensing and certification area are increasing. And for example, under House Bill 2800, we've increased added to our rules regarding nursing staffing and the adequacy of nursing coverage in hospitals. We don't need a fee increase to cover that now. We just want you to know that there may be a need for that in the future. And I didn't want there to be a misunderstanding about that. I feel completely comfortable in being candid with you about what we do need and what we don't need, and I wanted you to be sure about that. A second point that I'd like to make here is that this is a very diverse program area, and we have 97 different programs that are identified in your priority list. And when we talk about priorities, we usually think of from high to low. But I hope you'll agree with me in looking over that list and in listening to what we've been told over the past 3 days, we don't really have low priorities in public health. And it was a very difficult exercise both for the office administrators and for me to say which of these programs is first and which is last. And that's why I thought it was important to break them out by office and display them in the relevant areas so that you could take a closer look at that. And then that concludes our presentation of public health issues, an area which is not terribly dependent on general fund revenue, but which is of critical importance to Oregonians.
Thank you. Oh, you're still up?
Oh, thank you. The last part of our health services budget, and probably of greatest debate now, is the Office of Medical Assistance Programs, which is home to the Oregon Health Plan, which has received a great deal of attention in the last several weeks. I think there are four substantive committees which are examining the Oregon Health Plan, and Lynn Reed has had to make a presentation to each of them. And I, rather than duplicate what she is prepared to tell you, I'm going to ask her to walk you through that. We've provided some supplemental information, which I think is organized in a way that will probably answer most of the questions that you may have. I want to say that out of our governor's balanced budget, there's over $600 million in general fund in the Office of Medical Assistance Programs. That's a huge component of the state budget. And so when there are changes financially in the budget, they certainly affect our capacity to underwrite health care for Oregonians who can't get access otherwise. And this is an area about which we are tremendously concerned because it is linked to almost every objective we have in the Department of Human Services, whether it's about kids, families, getting people out of poverty and into self-sufficiency. Health care is a primary foundational issue. So this is the program area we've saved for last, and which I think will draw greatest attention.
Members, I requested, because this is such a complex issue, and because not that the others aren't as important, but we have this environment, I've been working on what we know as the Oregon Health Plan. I've asked the agency to give us a thorough walkthrough. And so, you know, if you want to know why this document is as thick as it is, we've had a meeting, and I told him to give us a 101 course, if you will, so that that the members will have a good understanding of what's involved when we talk about OMAP and talk about the Oregon Health Plan. So, Lynn, thank you, and welcome.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. I'm Lynn Reed, administrator for the Office of Medical Assistance Programs within the Department of Human Services. And I just want to start off by saying that I am a firm supporter of prepaid managed health care. And as a result of that, I'd like to prepay for my acronym syndrome. My money's too big.
Sure, glad you support prepaid.
Thank you. I will be talking from that supplemental handout that you've received in order to provide that basic Medicaid 101 overview. And it's laid out much like it would be in a course in terms of objectives that I hope to meet as we go through that information. I do want to be able to provide you with an understanding of what the public portion of the Oregon Health Plan is about and Medicaid and how they have evolved. Want to be able to identify the cost factors that are specific to the Oregon Health Plan and how they're driven by the broader health care market. I'd like to be able to identify the range of cost containment actions that we've put in place over the years of the Oregon Health Plan and to provide you with some outcomes data and comparative information in terms of the results that we've obtained in Oregon as a result of having the Oregon Health Plan. And lastly, to provide you with information that will allow you as decision makers some assistance in how you may want to reconfigure the Oregon Health Plan in order to meet the priority objectives of Oregon and still remain sustainable into the future. With that, I want to start at the beginning in terms of what a traditional Medicaid program is about. And I'm on page 3 of that document. The Medicaid program evolved out of action taken by the U.S. Congress in 1965. It was Title 19 of the Social Security Act. And it's a cooperative venture between the federal government and the states in terms of providing health care programs for low-income persons who fit in certain categories. And it brings in federal dollars to the state, and the state has to put up a portion of matching funds to go with the federal dollars. In order to participate in a federal Medicaid program and draw down those federal dollars, and let me just stop for a minute and say how important that is to our program. For every dollar we spend on Medicaid, the federal government puts in 60 cents, the state puts in 40 cents. We also have another program called the Children's Health Insurance Program that has an even better match. For every dollar spent in that program, the federal government puts in 72 cents and the state puts in 28 cents. So it's important to us to participate in this program in order to stretch the state dollars. There are certain things that are required in order to draw down those federal dollars. And one of the first things is that you must cover certain individuals. There are mandatory categories of people who need to be covered in a Medicaid program. And I'm on page 4. The first group is what are called temporary assistance for needy families. You'll commonly hear that referred to as TANF. This is families and children in the welfare assistance caseloads. There's a program called Poverty Level Medical, which covers children under age 6 up to 133% of the federal poverty level, under age 19 up to 100% of the federal poverty level. There is also a portion of the Poverty Level Medical program that covers pregnant women, and you have to cover up to 133% of the federal poverty level in order to, once again, these are the mandatory categories. There are optional categories that I'll talk about that go to higher levels. You have to cover seniors that meet certain federal eligibility criteria, and you have to cover persons with disabilities who also meet federal criteria. You also have to cover children in foster care and substitute care. And you have to cover a group for a limited medical benefit called Citizen Alien Waived Emergency Medical, shortened usually to its acronym of CAWEM. These are non-citizens who may be legal residents or illegal residents or illegally in the state or the country. And the only reason that they don't qualify for our program is because of their citizenship status. And we're required under the federal Medicaid program to provide emergency medical services to those individuals, as well as labor and delivery. On page 5 is a list of the optional categories of eligibility. Those include poverty level medical program for children above 133% of the poverty level, and you can go up to 185% in that program. Poverty level medical adults, those are the pregnant women, you can go above the required 133% up to 185%. And in Oregon, we do go up to 185% now for pregnant women. The Children's Health Insurance Program, the program I mentioned that has the enhanced federal match, and that's commonly called by its acronym, CHIP, you can go up to 200% of the federal poverty level. However, Oregon has chosen to go to 185%. Also, there are a couple of groups that I failed to list on that handout, parents of covered children. We do have some parents that are covered in our expansion category under our waivers. And back when we started the Oregon Health Plan, you couldn't cover those unless you have waivers. But today, they're an optional group. And we do cover them up to 100% of poverty. And another group that is optional that you're probably very familiar with is the Medically Needy Program. And that's a program, of course, that ended at the end of January of this year.
Lynn, you know, we experience some confusion as to what is embodied in the Medically Needy Program, and you might want to expound on that just a little bit.
Certainly, Madam Chair. The Medically Needy Program, these are individuals, as it was operated in Oregon, these are individuals who have income above the standards that they're individuals with either disabilities or age, over age 65, who, except for their income, would have qualified for one of our traditional required Medicaid programs, but their income is too high. And if they incur medical expenses that drop their income down to a level below what the other programs would require, then they could become eligible for under the Medically Needy Program. Their eligibility under that program would be for a limited benefit package. It included prescription drugs, mental health, chemical dependency, and transportation to access those covered services.
Are those services mandatory?
None of those services are mandatory in a traditional Medicaid program.
So you can determine the benefit?
Yes, we do have to go through a federal approval process for the Medically Needy Program, if you have one, to determine what benefits you'll cover. But the federal government had agreed to let us have those limited benefits as a part of that program. There were about 8,500 clients participating in that program when it ended. About 75% of them had Medicare coverage. So this was kind of a wraparound benefit package for the limited Medicare benefit package, which doesn't cover drugs, for example. And about 90% of the expenditures were for prescription drugs in that program. There are also categories which aren't on this page. I've forgotten to list them. Categories of eligibles which are not a part of traditional Medicaid, but states are able to expand who they cover with waivers from federal regulations. And, of course, Oregon has done that under the Oregon Health Plan. They typically include state-only programs, such as our former general assistance program. We were able to draw down federal dollars by getting waivers from the federal government to let those individuals qualify. Also, adults without children in the household were a group that we picked up as an expansion population under our waivers. In addition to having to cover certain people in your Medicaid program, you also have to cover certain benefits. On page 6 is the beginning of a list of benefits that you're required to cover. They include hospital services. I won't touch on every one of them. Lab and X-ray services, nursing facility services for those who are age 21 and older, physician services. This next one is an important one. It's early and periodic screening, diagnosis, and treatment for persons under age 19. Its acronym is EPSDT. And what this means is that for anyone under age 19 in a traditional Medicaid program, you would need to cover any service that is medically necessary for that child, whether or not your Medicaid program typically would cover that benefit. So although some services may be optional, they're not optional for children.
Up to 133, excuse me, Madam Chair.
Maybe Representative West.
Up to 133% of poverty?
Madam Chair, Representative Westland, that's correct. It depends upon where you take your eligibility levels. Children, basically we cover children now up to 185% of poverty level, and so and we're covering a wide range of services for children up to that level.
So if you take it up, you automatically fall under the
EPSDT
requirements.
That's correct. Okay. The other point, though, I need to make is that we do have a waiver from this requirement. Under traditional Medicaid, you have to provide this service. Oregon has a waiver under the Oregon Health Plan that allows us to use, and we'll talk later about the benefits under the Oregon Health Plan, but we have a prioritized list of conditions and treatments for those conditions. And we're able to use that prioritized list for children as well as adults because of our waiver from this requirement. Just mention on the next page 7, that also included under mandatory services are transportation services to access medical care, pregnancy-related services, family planning services, and the non-citizens that I mentioned before, the limited services for persons eligible under that program. Some of the optional categories, which begin on page 8 under a Medicaid program, you won't think seem like they should be optional for a basic benefit package, but they are under federal regulations. They include things like treatment for alcohol and drug abuse, dental services, medical supplies and equipment such as prosthetic devices. On the page 9, mental health service treatment services, organ transplants. Prescription drugs are optional from a federal perspective. Preventive services, vision services. So there are a wide range of things here that are optional from the federal government perspective. All states cover prescription drugs. There isn't anyone that has elected not to cover drugs under their traditional Medicaid programs.
Madam Chair.
Representative Wesson.
Do any states elect not to cover CD or mental health?
You just owe the pig, Ms.
Okay, I owe the pig.
Madam Chair, Representative Westland, we'll have to research that one for you. We do have a document that will provide us with that information.
That'd be great.
In addition to having to cover certain people and having to cover certain services, on page 10 there's some additional federal requirements listed. Your state Medicaid program has to be statewide. You can't just offer it in one particular county or leave out a county. The benefits have to be comparable. And so you provide similar range of benefits for all your eligibility groups across the state. There has to be freedom of choice so that a Medicaid recipient can choose any provider who is participating in the Medicaid program. Once again, all of these things are subject to getting waivers to allow you to do something different, and we have done that with managed care. You cannot discriminate in your Medicaid program based on a person's condition. And our prioritized list of benefits, which is based on conditions and treatments, has been carefully developed and crafted to make sure that it's not in conflict with this requirement. You have to provide a reasonable amount of services. You can't have certain arbitrary limits. it needs to be basically a reasonable range of services in a given category. Also, you have to have payments that are sufficient to ensure client access to providers, which can be a challenge.
Senator Moore.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Is there a threshold that has been determined by statute or by federal rule as to what the sufficiency is?
Madam Chair, Senator Morris, no, we don't have something that's definitive that would make it easier in terms of making some program choices. Generally, it's a matter of some interaction with the federal government in terms of where they would allow limits, where they won't. We generally think about it as you have to be in the 90-95% range of covering all services in order to be able to pass the muster. And with our, once again, with our prioritized benefit package, we have some opportunities available to us, although we have to get federal approval, once again, to have limits.
But, just to follow up, how would we know when we are insufficient? I'm going to take you first.
Mm-hmm.
And where we would have then a problem with that.
Madam Chair, it'll generally be pointed out to us by someone who is concerned about a benefit that they believe should be covered.
I'm looking at the providers now. I'm talking about the access issue.
Oh, I'm sorry.
The payment sufficient to ensure client access to providers.
Madam Chair, an example of that would be most all of our payment mechanisms, the methodologies we use to derive our payments, are incorporated in what's called a state plan. And the state plan is filed with the federal government, with the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services, and they have to approve every change to that state plan amendment. So, for example, we wanted to lower the reimbursement rate to pharmacies. And instead of paying our current rate of the average wholesale price minus 14%, we wanted to lower the rate to average wholesale price minus 17%. We submitted a state plan amendment to the federal government to do that. And what they asked us to do, they asked a number of questions as follow-up to that request. And a part of what they were trying to get at was, will you have access? Will the pharmacy still participate in your Medicaid program and serve your clients? And in that dialogue in further discussions with the pharmacies, we amended that request to average wholesale price minus 15%. We still don't have federal approval for that, but that's what they look at. They ask us to provide enough information that gives them some assurance that there's access there.
But that's rather subjective because, you know, a way of looking at whether or not there is access, and I guess I'm looking for maybe your federal counterpart doesn't have some range of guidelines, because what may be a rate for California may be a different rate established for Oregon based on where we are, not only, you know, in our economy of scales. And so I guess my question is, you know, are vice versa, the state of Washington.
Madam Chair, that's very true. And the federal government does take that into consideration because, for coming back to the example of the pharmacies, there was a National Office of Inspector General report that talked about acquisition costs for prescription drugs, and they had evaluated 10 or 15 states, was average wholesale price minus 17%, which was the very thing we were asking for. But they wouldn't accept that report as being indicative of whether or not that was adequate reimbursement for Oregon. But it is a subjective interaction, unless you've gone out and done some definitive study that you can provide to the federal government. Over the years, the federal government or federal requirements generally, they have changed generally they've broadened who's eligible for Medicaid or who you're required to cover under your Medicaid program, and they've broadened coverage requirements. So they've become somewhat more regulatory in nature as the years have gone on.
How do we assess access? How do we gauge access in order for us to get the information to the feds in order to have them to render an opinion or a decision?
Madam Chair, we generally don't have to demonstrate an access that we have a certain level of access unless we're coming in and asking for a change to the state plan. And sometimes even then they don't ask for a definitive study. One of the ways in which we have guaranteed access over the years was by increasing our managed care capacity. What we found with our managed care plans was that they brought us some true increased access to providers. Providers who in the past would not serve our Medicaid clients because of our, perhaps because of our low reimbursement rates, who under a managed care plan, they were willing to be a part of a community solution and take their share of patients who might have a lower reimbursement accompanying them. Or in the case of, as we started the Oregon Health Plan, we had some increased dollars we put into the capitation rates we paid the managed care plan so that they could in turn pay providers better than we were doing in fee for service. And in looking at that, we also measure the managed care plans in terms of what kind of capacity do they have to serve the people who are enrolled with them. And the monitoring there takes place in a number of, it's a bit of an art in terms of determining where there is that adequate capacity. It has to do with the number of, for example, physicians, the number of physicians participating, how many of them are taking new patients versus established patients. What is the general physician load in the community? Is it a community that already has a shortage of physicians? We look
looking
at things
at
like that.
Our rates and looking at over time, do we have any trend line data that says we're losing, gaining providers, docs? You know, I know we've had problems with some capacity mm-hmm. issues. And over a range of time, just where are we here in Oregon?
Madam Chair, when we first started the Oregon Health Plan, we had great participation of physicians. And our real source there is some periodic surveys that the Oregon Medical Association does. And back at its peak, those surveys were showing about a 95% participation in the Oregon Health Plan. And I believe I heard Scott Gallant maybe testifying to Representative Westland's committee talking about how that had degraded. And I'm thinking perhaps he said something around 90%. I don't know if that...
Well, I think it's about 70%.
Yeah, okay. We'll confirm that information for you.
Well, would you get that information on the docs and not only the docs, but I know we've had problems with some of the other entities that we do business with as to are we losing providers? What's occurring in this whole access issue piece? That would be most helpful.
Right. Well, we can get the survey information, Madam Chair, from the Oregon Medical Association. We have some information from our database in the fee-for-service delivery system, although it may not give you a true picture. If somebody is billed as they can be active in our database, but that may not be a big contribution to access.
And the same is true with our pharmacists, particularly if we look at, you know, the end of the independents and the retail, are we losing them? Just what is the status? Senator Morris.
Do you know the percentage of hospitals that are for-profit and not-for-profit in the state?
Madam Chair, Senator Morris, I do not know that. We can get that information from the Office for Oregon Health Policy and Research, though.
Madam Chair, it seems to me that's... You know, I would suspect that the majority are not for profit, and not-for-profits cannot deny access. So we as the public body need to be very careful about pushing down into these not-for-profits an impossible situation, and I think we're approaching that. That's an editorial comment.
Yeah. Well, I think the whole entire issue, whether you're talking about the hospital or you're talking about docs and the pharmacists and those entities in the healthcare delivery system that are providing services for us, the payments become a huge part of the access issue. I know that the good doc, Representative Bates, is nodding his head. Because it determines whether or not we're going to retain those providers within our system as we deliver services. So as much information as you can get us, land on trend lines of it as possible, it would be appreciated.
We will do that, Madam Chair, Senator Morris. Moving on to page 11, it was coming out of operating a traditional Medicaid program. Looking at the situation at that point in time, there wasn't an equitable allocation of health care resources in Oregon. Those people who qualified for the Medicaid program had generous benefits, while there were others in the state who received no health care. Employer-sponsored coverage generally provided good benefits, but yet we still have 400,000 Oregonians at that point in time. Who were caught in the middle and didn't have any coverage at all. And one-third of those fell below the poverty level. So that meant that for those individuals, getting back to the issue, this is another issue of cost shift, not the one Senator Morse was specifically talking about, but for individuals who didn't have any coverage, they would access care when the condition became bad enough through hospital emergency rooms, which is a more expensive way to access care, and you're not catching necessarily an illness or treating at the appropriate time. The costs are shifted to other payers. Premiums rise. That sometimes causes employers then to drop coverage and continues to build and escalate. And so it was that environment that led in 1987 to a group of citizens coming together to look at that situation and how they could make a difference. And this was a broad-based group. It included healthcare providers, consumers of healthcare, business, labor, insurers, lawmakers, and even government bureaucrats, and they came together around a common objective, which was to keep Oregonians healthy. And they felt that in order to do that, they needed to address three basic questions. Who is covered, what is covered, and how is it financed and delivered? And you'll find those are probably the very questions before you today, 15 years later. But that's where the genesis of the Oregon Health Plan started, with those questions. Out of that group, there was agreement reached that on page 13, that all citizens should have universal access to basic level of care. That society is responsible for financing care for poor people. That there needs to be a process to define what a basic level of care is. That process should be based on criteria that are publicly debated, that reflect societal values, and consider the good of society as a whole. The healthcare delivery system should encourage, or must encourage the use of services and procedures that are effective and appropriate and that discourage overtreatment. And also a recognition that health care is just one important factor affecting people's health, that it has to be balanced with other programs. So you can't say your single goal is to get health care. What we really want to do is make a difference in the health of individuals. On page 14, there was also agreement that the funding should be explicit and economically sustainable, which, of course, our world has changed a lot in the intervening 15 years. And that there needed to be clear accountability in terms of allocating the resources for health care and what the human consequences are of those choices. And some of those have become very real in today's world in time of budget shortfall. The goals for the original Oregon Health Plan were to reduce the percentage on page 15, to reduce the percentage of Oregonians without health coverage, to contain the rate of growth of health care expenditures, to eliminate cost shifting, to improve the quality of health care, and to promote accountability for explicit priorities. We've done better on some of these than others. At different points in time over the last 10 years that the Oregon Health Plan has been in operation, we've had better success at different points in time over that continuum. Out of that work did indeed emerge the Oregon Health Plan. It's a comprehensive health care reform plan. It included private market programs, which are not the ones I'm going to focus on now. I know that you'll be hearing from Rocky King shortly to talk about those. But under the private market components of the Oregon Health Plan, it included originally an employer mandate, commonly called a player pay system, where employers were going to be required to provide coverage to their workers and their dependents, or else pay into a fund for those individuals. Now, that was an important, a critical piece of the broad-based health care reform that had been anticipated in terms of achieving goals, and it was never implemented. There were insurance market reforms that were put in place in the mid-90s. A high-risk pool was set up in the early 90s, that dealt with providing an access point to insurance for those people who were either priced out of the market or locked out of the market because the commercial insurance market wasn't willing to accept the risk of their high-cost cases. And later added to that program was the Family Health Insurance Assistance Program, commonly referred to by its acronym, FEOP, and that was implemented in 1998. The public programs, which are administered by the Department of Human Services, included the Medicaid portion of the Oregon Health Plan, which was implemented in 1994, and the Children's Health Insurance Program, which was implemented in 1998. In addition to that, there are other aspects of Medicaid that move beyond the Oregon Health Plan. They include things like the long-term care services, some services for developmentally disabled, and others that aren't a part of the Office of Medical Assistance Programs budget, but they are a part of Medicaid. I think probably when Jean Thorne was here and gave an overview several weeks ago, she would have mentioned the large amount of Medicaid funding that is throughout the department. Moving to page 17, I just want to mention the waivers from federal regulations that we obtained in order to implement the Oregon Health Plan. There were three primary areas that we secured waivers in. One was to make Medicaid available to most people living in the in poverty, because remember, under traditional Medicaid, you had to fit in certain categories in order to qualify. You might be poor, you might even be medically vulnerable, but unless you fit in the right category, you couldn't have access to Medicaid coverage. So we got a waiver that allowed us to do that. We also needed a waiver to provide benefits based on our priority list of conditions and treatments. And we got a waiver to allow us to reimburse managed care plans at rates that would cover reasonable cost. In the traditional Medicaid program, we couldn't pay those kind of capitation rates. However, over the intervening years, as we operated the Oregon Health Plan, we continued to see caseload and inflationary costs increase. The federal government was not responsible to what was to be our primary tool for containing costs, in terms of reducing benefits by drawing the line on the prioritized list. The employer mandate, of course, was not implemented. So out of that, it was determined we really needed a new strategy in Oregon. And in moving to page 19, The 2001 legislature enacted House Bill 2519, and that established what we have called the Oregon Health Plan 2. And the goals under this new reconfigured Oregon Health Plan were to get better control over costs, to have more flexibility with the federal government in terms of imposing cost sharing on participants, benefit changes, and even eligibility caps in order to have more flexibility at the state level. We also wanted to have the ability to draw down federal funds to support private market programs. In particular, we were talking about the Family Health Insurance Assistance Program, which when it started in 1998, up until OHP 2 was implemented, was only state funds. And House Bill 2519 also kind of redirected the focus of that program with a greater emphasis on providing employer-sponsored coverage, making it available for persons of low income. We also wanted to expand coverage to more uninsured people above 100% of the poverty level. That was one of the goals with OHP 2. Now, we haven't been able to implement that piece of it to any significant degree in the public side of the program, but we have been able to expand coverage under the private-based FEOP program.
How much have we expanded that?
Pardon me?
Oh, no, Rocky will be here, so he'll talk about that.
Oh, I'm FEOP. Yeah, I would defer to Rocky on that. And also a goal was to address the sustainability of the Oregon Health Plan into the future. Now, this was just two short years ago where we thought that what came out of House Bill 2519 would afford us the tools to do this.
For those of us who were sitting and in involved in this, we just kind of come, and it doesn't seem like two short years ago.
With five or six special sessions since then.
It's like a lot longer.
It does, doesn't it?
Yeah, one of the significant things it did do, though, was it allowed the Oregon Health Plan to continue, at least to now. And it did give us some flexibility. We did exercise that flexibility as we've dealt with budget. On page 20, just wanted to talk about, we got new waivers when we got the Oregon Health Plan 2 approved by the federal government. And this program, it has approval from the federal government to run for 5 years. And it was October 2002 when the federal government gave us approval to move forward. That those waivers allow us to have different benefit packages for our Medicaid population. So we have our expansion categories, which are about a fourth of our Medicaid clients that are only eligible because we started the Oregon Health Plan. They're all adults. They're about 100,000 people, ages 19 through 64. And we could have a different benefit package for that group versus our traditional Medicaid categories of eligibles. We also got a waiver that would allow us to have the flexibility to reduce benefits for that expansion population, which we've already taken advantage of, without having to get federal pre-approval. We got flexibility to cap or limit enrollment for the expansion population. We have already delayed one portion of the expansion, which was to go above. We were going to go to 110% of the federal poverty level in February, and that's been delayed. Right now it's on the books as delayed to July. You know, its future, of course, comes out of the session and the decisions you make. We received approval, a waiver in order to for that expansion population once again to charge what are called mandatory copayments. In the traditional Medicaid program, you can have copayments for certain people for certain services at nominal levels, but if the client doesn't pay that copayment, the provider cannot refuse treatment. Well, this gave us a waiver that allowed us for this particular population to give that provider the opportunity to refuse treatment if the individual did not make the copayment.
The hospital's an exception?
Madam Chair, the hospitals are not an exception. Under the expansion populations, there is a $250 copayment for a hospital inpatient admission, a $50 copayment for emergency room. And let me rephrase that. From Medicaid rules, they're not an exception. From Medicaid rules, they could refuse to provide that treatment. We wouldn't require them to do so, but there are other higher level requirements that are federal that don't allow hospitals to turn away emergency situations. And physicians would indicate that there are similar requirements upon them. If they're engaged in a course of treatment, they can't just turn someone away because they don't have the ability to pay. I'm just saying we've removed ourselves from that level of burden on them and haven't impacted those other regulators. We also gain the ability to charge higher premiums for this expansion population and to enforce the collection of those premiums. And, of course, we're just now we set up this took effect in February, and we set it up so there'd be a grace period for people to make their February payment. And we found out of approximately 100,000 eligibles, about 15,000 people were going to lose their coverage on April 1st because they hadn't made their February payment. We did delay enacting that loss of eligibility for another month, so it'll be May 1st before we see the actual impact of enforcing the requirement that people make their premiums payments on a monthly basis within the grace period. And then another waiver we gained was the one that would allow us to require that expansion population to be uninsured for 6 months prior to qualifying for Medicaid coverage. And that's in line with some of the things the federal government has put in place for other programs like the Children's Health Insurance Program. We also secured approval to make the beginning date of eligibility for this expansion population a future effective date as opposed to retroactive to the date that they applied for service. And this has a significant impact, for example, on hospitals, where hospitals typically would have somebody come in need of care, could be trauma care even, they would be able to establish that as a date of request for Oregon Health Plan coverage, and thus if the person was found eligible, they'd get paid back to that beginning date of service. And now the date of eligibility will be a future effective date as opposed to going back and picking up that coverage. I'll just touch on the last two items here, and then I can see we're approaching the 3 o'clock hour here. We secured a waiver that allowed us to have the flexibility to increase the income standard in terms of covering more people, to go above the 100% of the poverty level up to as high as 185% of the federal poverty level, which at the time this was envisioned, we believed we could go quite a ways up within the available dollars that we would otherwise have been spending on the program at that time. And the last thing that we gained a waiver for was to claim that federal match for the Family Health Insurance Assistance Program. And much of the match in that program is at the higher match rate, where it's 72% federal money to 28% state money. And with that, if it's your desire, I will stop there.
I will
stop there.
Think that we can, this is probably a good place to, Senator Morris.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I would just like to express appreciation, being the new member on this panel, for the quality of your presentation. It's very, very good, and it's very helpful to me, so thank you very much.
Thank you.
Maybe this is a question to Representative Westland. How does Oregon compare, and maybe to you also, Madam Mary, to the other 49 states with respect to the amount and the quality of care that we provide, but the Medicaid OHP component versus the other states? Do we know that?
I'm going to say this as a generalization, and I don't know if there's any empirical rankings, but I will say that as a generalization, we have a higher percentage of coverage, and within that coverage, a much richer benefits package. Where that ranks us, I couldn't tell you. In fact, the more I think about it, I think we're about in the middle in terms of numbers covered with a richer benefits package.
That may be something that Lynn could help us with.
Madam Chair, Senator Morrison, Representative Westland, we actually did try to answer the question in terms of how we compared in terms of the benefits we cover compared to other states. We did that in response to one of the questions raised at your committee, Representative Westland, although we didn't actually present the information. It was just a written follow-up. And the information was not readily available. We were just able to take a look at a couple of kinds of optional services to see how Oregon did compared to some surrounding states. It's not something easily obtained, but I can share that information with you. And later when we talk about Judy Moore Peterson from our office, we'll be presenting information on our outcomes, and she'll be able to talk a little bit about some of the national measures that are out there and how Oregon compares with other states in that respect, getting at that issue of quality of care. And that may be helpful to you as well.
Thank you.
Thank you. Representative Bate.
Madam Chair, Lynn, I think we might be able to direct some questions that I know you have pieces of that will help Senator Morris. One is to compare the cost per patient of the Oregon Health Plan against other Medicaid plans across the nation, because I've seen that figure. I can't remember exactly what it was. The other one is to look on a poverty-adjusted basis of how many people we have enrolled in the plan. By that, I mean some states have a real high poverty level, so they'll have more people as a percentage of the total population. So looking at the number of people we have in poverty, how many we have in the plan would be helpful. I've seen that once before, too.
We have provided that information.
Yes, I've seen that.
We have both of those pieces of information. In terms of the cost per eligible, that'll come out and is in this document when Judy Moore Peterson does her portion of the presentation. In terms of the poverty level, where we are in the poverty level scale and the percentage of our population compared to other states, we have all, although it's not in this document, we have prepared that information before for Representative Westland's committee, and we'll bring a handout with that information.
And Madam Chair, and this is part of an answer.
Representative Westland.
I think Representative Bates interjected a good variable in the conversation. You know, what do we do compared to what? And, I mean, without question, I mean, for all the good, the bad, and the ugly of, you know, the right and the wrong things we do, I think it's very fair to say that we do much more with much less than most is maybe a way to sum it up.
Mm-hmm. I think that's what you'll find when you see the figures. But I want to revisit those for...
Representative Bates.
Right.
Yeah, I'm sorry.
We will, this document, and I did ask Lynn to prepare this because I recognize that we do have about three members on this panel, at least, who have not had the history of the Oregon Health Plan. And so, and then even those who have had, I think it's good to refresh one's memory in the walkthrough. So our 101 course is very much appreciated, Lynn. And any comparison data that you can bring forward to us as we go through the process would be appreciated, and I thank you much. And with that, we are adjourned until tomorrow.